Good afternoon, members. I call this meeting of the Committee of Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy to order. Members, please mute your mic. This remote hearing is conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can be viewed at the House Television webcast if you have access. And the Committee Legislative Assistant will now take the roll.
Noor.
Noor present.
Jaejeong. Jaejeong. Hamilton.
Present.
Baker. Baker. Gavney. Gavney. Frankie.
Present.
Greenman.
Present.
Haley. Haley. Juergens.
Present.
Cagle.
Present.
Batiza Watun.
Present.
Olson.
Present.
Tujong. Tujong. Jaejeong is on the chat saying that he cannot hear audio. He is present. Baker. Baker. Gavney.
Gavney present.
Haley. Haley. Tujong. Tujong. We have quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Having said that, we do have a quorum present. I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes for January 13th.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liz Olson moves the approval of the minutes for January 13. Any discussions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. The minutes for January 13 are approved. Members, we do have a hearing today based on the unemployment benefits, and we do have the commissioner and staff here who will help us go through this process. So this is an opportunity for us to learn about the unemployment benefits and hear more about the background. But we do have an urgent bill that we would like to present. And I don't know if Vice Chair Jaejeong is able to connect. There he goes.
Sorry about that.
Great. So just wanted to explain today, we do have the rules for the committee presented to all of you. I'm sure you have received it and you have read the procedures for the rules for this committee. And I would like to ask if you have any questions. We are more flexible. It's not a rigid process. If you have any questions, please let me know. Otherwise, we would like to proceed with the bill in front of us today. I'm not hearing any, so if you have any questions, please always let me know or let Travis know, the committee administrator, for any questions in regards to the rules that we've established for this committee. So with that, I just wanted to ask Chair Jaejeong to guide us in the presentation for the bill, which is House File 135.
All right, Chair Noor, to your bill, House File 135.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we do have an urgent bill that we wanted to present. I move
Mr. Chair. House File. Oh, sorry. I said we need the motion, but you were about to make it. Right. My apologies for interrupting. Sorry.
Thank you so much, Travis, for the reminder. I move House File 135 to be recommended to be placed on the general register, Mr. Chair.
All right, to your bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to give a quick background on this issue. On or before December 15th of every year, each taxpaying employer with an active account is notified of their unemployment insurance tax rate for the following year. I'll do my best to explain this process, and if I make any mistakes, I know the staff and the commission are here to explain further. We all know 2020 was a year like no other year. The unemployment benefits gave Minnesotans a lifeline due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Over a million claims were filed by workers compared to 155,000 during the prior year. Claims are still being processed. Claims are still being processed through the system as we speak today based on the new federal program. And there are so many difficulties in terms of getting an accurate assessment for the experience rating. The federal reimbursement for the waiting week and the shared work benefits are still in the works. We haven't received all the reimbursement based on legislation that we passed previously. We also passed a legislation to ensure that benefits paid due to COVID-19 should not be used to compute the unemployment tax rate. Members, the unemployment benefits are primarily funded through the quarterly unemployment insurance tax into the Minnesota Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. The tax system is experience rated. New employers' tax rate depends on the business type. Their type rate is based on the average rate of all Minnesota employers or high experience rating industries, whichever that may determine the new employers. Just to give you another quick background, the employer's tax rate is based on the formula that takes into account 48 calendar months ending on the previous year on June 30th. It's calculated by dividing 125% of the unemployment benefits charged to the employer's account by the total taxable wages paid by all their employees. As for the taxable wage base, it's 60% of Minnesota's average annual wage on June 30th of the previous year. The UI tax is paid on the gross wage paid to each employee up to the taxable wage base for the 2020. It was $35,000, which was used to compute the tax rate. The lowest tax rate that can be assigned is the base tax rate, which is 0.10% up to 0.50%. And it's determined on March 31 of the prior year. The highest tax rate that can be assigned is maximum allowable experience rating, which is 8.90% by law plus maximum base rate up to 0.5%. And it gives you 9.40%. That's how it's assessed. And sometimes there's assessment and also fees based on borrowing from the federal government. Luckily, this session, we had 0% from the federal government. That's just a quick overview of the program, and we will hear more about unemployment as the day goes by. With that, I just wanted to welcome Commissioner Groves to give us a highlight of this request or this bill.
Commissioner Groves, state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Grove. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you, Chair, members, for taking up this matter today. It is an urgent matter, and I think Representative Nord did a fantastic job of describing this. Essentially, what we're talking about is how employers pay into the trust fund that then provides unemployment insurance benefits to Minnesotans. And there are a variety of taxes that make up that trust fund pathway, but the experience rating is the one that really focuses on, you know, what was an employer's record over the previous 4 years? How many people did they hire? How many people did they fire? This is a key element of making sure that we encourage employers to try to keep workers, you know, on site and in their firms, and therefore keeping jobs available for Minnesotans. Of course, in the pandemic, all of that changes very rapidly, and experience ratings during a pandemic are sort of impossible to decouple from normal times. One of the things that we've recognized from the very beginning of this pandemic is there was going to be a lot of layoffs due to COVID-19 that had really nothing to do with an employer's track record or perspective or industry, but just had to do with a once-in-a-century pandemic. And so from the very beginning, Governor Walz issued an executive order that said anybody who was let go based on COVID-19 reasons, whether they be reductions in size via consumer confidence or the need to dial back to protect people's health, that employers would be held harmless for those charges. But at the end of the day, we do need to still calculate an experience rating every year, as Representative said, to ensure that we are doling out the right or charging the right taxes for every employer. And to do so now, in the middle of really still peak conditions for unemployment insurance in this pandemic, would be administratively impossible. To go through every employer's record and parse out who was laid off from COVID versus who was laid off for regular reasons is something the program simply couldn't handle. And given statute requires us to do it, we think that the win-win situation for everyone, as the representative has highlighted here, is to hold employers essentially harmless for the last year, to say, look, 2020 was an unprecedented year for workers in our state and for businesses, and let's just carry forward that experience rating from 2019 into 2021, and then at the end of this year, go back and do that work of parsing out the hirings and firings based on the pandemic. To be clear, this really is just a win-win for everybody who's involved in the program. For employers, they are held harmless based on the pandemic. Workers don't suffer the threat of potentially having to grind the program to a halt while we divert resources to doing an immense amount of calculations, which is what it would take place, what it would require to make this adjustment now. And Minnesota as a state, as a whole, benefits from just having a fair level playing field based on the pandemic for the calculation of these experience ratings. I think it's important to point out, because I know a lot of people will have questions about the trust fund and how it's repaid, and you'll hear more about that a little bit later from our UI director, Jim Hegman, but raising experience ratings really isn't the way that you pay back the trust fund. The primary way that we're going to tackle that, and the states always tackle that, is through the base tax rate and through additional assessments. So this isn't a situation of us sort of kicking the can down the road of how we're going to pay back unemployment insurance. That's not this at all. This is simply making sure we can continue to administer a program effectively and hold employers harmless. I'll just add, just for context, so you know how critical it is to keep the team focused on administering the program itself. We are still administering about 380,000 weekly benefit requests every single week. So the program is kicking at all cylinders. The team is working 7 days a week to get those monies out. We're also standing up three separate federal programs right now, one for independent contractors, one for extending unemployment insurance, one for that $300 top-off, and we're working on a fourth, which is going to be the expansion of a new benefit for those who have kind of a mixed income situation. So there's just an extraordinary amount of kind of day-to-day payment work and program administration the team is going to remain focused on, and we hope, thanks to this bill, being able to calculate those experience ratings in the future. When we're on the other side of this pandemic. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we urgently request that you pass this legislation and are grateful to Representative Noor for bringing it forward.
Thank you, commissioners. Members, any questions? All right, then. Chair Noor, would you like to remove?
Mr. Chair, I see...
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. And whether this is to Chair Noor or to the commissioner, how will this impact the following year? Will it go back to how it's previously calculated or have any impact at all for the following year? Thank you.
Chair Noor?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer that to the commissioner.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, great question. This bill just addresses this year's experience rating calculation. So the practice would be next year, really would be at the end of this year, December of this year, we would then do the work of going back and decoupling again those layoffs that were from COVID-19 related reasons or just the normal course of business. So this is a 1 year carry forward of that 2019 rate. It's not an indefinite extension of that rate.
Right. Representative Hamilton?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions from the members? I see no hands. Chair Noor, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 135 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
All right, Chair Noor renews his motion that the House File 135 be placed on the General Register, and I believe the clerk will take the roll.
Aye.
Jay Zhang.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Aye.
Baker. Baker. Daphne.
Aye.
Frankie.
Abstain.
Greenman.
Aye.
Haley. Jurgens.
Aye.
Cagle.
Aye.
Katiza Watun.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Tujong.
Aye.
Going back. Haley. Haley. The motion prevailed, Chair. If you want, I can read out the vote too. Eleven yes, two absent, one abstained.
Hello, bill passes, moves forward. Mr. Chair, you can no chair the committee again.
Thank you, Representative Jay Shong, Chair, Mr. Chair. So thank you so much, Commissioner. We look forward to presenting this bill in the next few days in the House on the floor, and I will ask for your support because this is much needed because of the delay. Many employers have been impacted by this, so we want to give them assurance and make sure that there's no harm. We can hold employers harmless during this challenging time. So thank you so much. With that, we do have the discussion on the unemployment, and we do have the director, Jim Hegman, who's going to be presenting. Please welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Hegman. I am the program director for unemployment insurance at DEED.
Well, welcome, and please, I don't know if you wanted to share the slides for the presentation.
I can do that, yes. Travis, do I share my screen, or how would you like to handle this?
I believe Darielle was going to take care of that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's fine.
That's okay. I can do it, Darielle.
Okay, whatever you prefer.
Pardon the logistics here.
And Travis, if I might, I do believe Commissioner Grove was going to say a couple words at the top, if that's okay, for Chair Noor and the committee.
Thank you. Commissioner, please proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Just briefly, because Jim is the true expert on unemployment insurance, not only here in Minnesota, but nationally. But I did just want to offer a couple of words just to frame this up for you. First of all, thanks for having us here to talk about this program. It has been one of the bulwark programs of this COVID-19 pandemic response. And the last year has been really extraordinary. I'm sure if you followed the news, you've seen in so many states lines around the block for people to fill out paper applications, websites crashing because the system couldn't withhold the load. Minnesota has not found itself in that position. And we're very, very grateful to have a long history of a very strong program in the state for unemployment insurance. Part of it is we're a seasonal economy. We're used to sort of ramping up and ramping back down when cold weather hits. But I think really it's largely a testament to the leadership of Jim Hegman and his amazing team at this division, who've just always been able to be nimble, thoughtful, and judicious in administering a really important program to the state. We have had to rapidly increase our operational capacity due to the unprecedented amount of claims we've had in this last year, whether it's ramping up staff or our technology. We've had to find new ways to deliver phone service and translations during an incredible volume of incoming calls from your constituents across the state. This is a program that in good times is winning awards from national organizations on effective administration, and in challenging times really has risen to the challenge that we've all had. in our state, not only just handling the claims, but administering these new federal programs that I mentioned a moment ago. Minnesota was either the first or among the first few states to administer every single one of those new federal programs that came down, which is, I think, just a testament to the team and the hard work in that division. This program matters. It matters for every single person in the state, most of whom this year never ever believed they would be on unemployment insurance. That wasn't a part of their plan for 2020. But helping them navigate that and helping make sure that we get every claim right and we don't, working harder to make sure we do, is just a hallmark of this team. And, you know, their kind of unofficial model for so many years has been everything we do inside the building is for those who are outside the building. And as you'll see when Jim walks through some of what the team has faced this year, I think you'll be impressed as I am at just how much hard work has gone into all that. So I would also just like to thank all of you over the last year for raising issues to us. You have made this program better. You have made us better at administering it, whether it's an individual constituent issue or an idea or a thought. Working closely with the legislature is critical to getting this program right, because it's literally keeping food on the tables for millions of Minnesotans throughout a difficult year. So I just wanted to offer that context. Thrilled for me to hear from Jim and have a conversation about this program and ways we can continue to make it grow. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will echo the same sentiments. We really appreciate the dedicated work from staff who have done a tremendous job to ensure that the integrity of our system and be able to support our communities. We do have a robust program, so thank you so much. With that, Mr. Hegman, please proceed. Hegman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the kind words as well, Commissioner Grove. Thank you, members. Hopefully this will work properly. There we go. From the outset of the pandemic, we'd understood our role to be largely to make the steps that had to be taken to protect our healthcare system and to make some of the safe at home orders practical. We had to do our job, and we had to make sure we did it in a timely fashion and acted quickly to ensure that these benefits were relevant and helped families and businesses stay afloat during this difficult time. If we had delayed, it would have hurt families, it would have hurt businesses. It would make staying home and staying safe just that much harder. We recognize that many Minnesotans who are assisting are living from paycheck to paycheck. So an absence of this income from this program would have severely affected them and their families. And we are glad and to have had an opportunity to play our part in the response to the pandemic. And on behalf of about 380 of us in the unemployment insurance program, we hope that we've done our work as well as we know we've done it as well as we possibly can. We hope we've made a difference during this difficult time for our friends, our families, and fellow Minnesotans. As Commissioner Grove mentioned, it has been a year like none other. As of right now, some of these numbers move so quickly that they're already out of date after we've produced this PowerPoint. So the actual amount paid is now over $10 billion so far as a result of the pandemic. There have, in fact, been over 24 million payments that have left our program over the last now 10 months. We as a way to kind of make sense of that many payments, we suggest what it would look like if we still printed checks and we laid them end to end. Currently, that's 3,245 miles, which would stretch from the United States to London. So that's an awful lot of activity in a relatively short period of time. So far, over 2020, we paid 814,000 Minnesotans. Last year, the same count was 143,000, so pretty significant difference. Minnesota is one of the few states that was able to maintain its timely payment throughout the course of the pandemic. Most states fall very far behind. We actually met and exceeded the federal timeliness standards for making payments. And again, this was a goal and what we spent a lot of our time and energy trying to make sure that we achieved. In a normal year, we would handle maybe 200,000-300,000 issues in a year. We've already logged over 900,000. This is a function of the amount of activity that's passing through the system. We were able to, so far, resolve 98% of those. We still have a lot of catching up we need to do just from sheer volume, but we've done pretty well overall. This is sort of a breakout of the amount that's actually been paid out in benefits so far. Again, the numbers are moving all the time. So as of just a little bit ago, the actual number for regular unemployment benefits is $3.7 billion. For comparison, last year, that was $800 million. Pandemic unemployment assistance, that's the program the commissioner mentioned that pays benefits to people who are not eligible for the regular UI program. A lot of these folks would be new labor market entrants or self-employed individuals. And that's about $677 million so far. PUC, which is an extension program, a federal extension program, is now up to $640 million. The extended benefits program is $86 million. That is now triggered off in Minnesota. TRA program is $2.5 million. It's a very small program. And the supplemental payments, what the commissioner described as top-off payments, is now at about $5 billion. In order to sort of get a handle on the scale of what's occurred, what we try to do is put in perspective of the history of the program. The graph that you can see in front of you, the lower line reflects initial claims from 2019, so the year before the pandemic. The upper line, it's purple in this drawing, that's actually 2009. That was the previous highest year of activity for initial claims. Initial claims are new claims for folks newly unemployed. So that's comparing 2009 to 2019. And you can see there's a huge difference between those 2 years. This is what we see if we use the same data now to compare 2009, 2019, and 2020. The dark black line illustrates what happened roughly in the middle of March. That's a straight vertical line that goes from a relatively low number. We had a fairly moderate year coming into the pandemic and went up to, I believe it was 115,000 claims, almost 116,000 that we took in 1 week. And then it has stayed high since then. So it calmed down a little bit, but historically much, much higher than during the Great Recession and for a very long period of time, and is still well above the sort of numbers we saw during the Great Recession. For a little bit more perspective, this is actually the last 15 years, and there's a little upward spike of data for 2011. That was the previous record. That was 18,000 claims in 1 week. That happened during the state shutdown in 2011. That's now completely eclipsed by what occurred in 2020. So almost 100,000 more claims in that single week than our prior record. This is a graph illustrating the number of weekly requests that we're processing. The lower line illustrates 2019. The upper one is 2020. You can see from this line that we had weeks where I believe we're at 570,000 weekly requests per week. Prior record was 240,000. So we more than doubled that and stayed there for a very long period of time. And we're still very busy, as the commissioner said, around 360,000, 380,000 current active folks requesting benefits. So again, this is a measure both of the activity level in the program and also the need and the situation that a lot of workers and self-employed individuals find themselves in today. So it's a measure of both of those things. Our response, as the commissioner said, we tried to move as quickly as we could to handle what we weren't really sure was going to happen. I don't think any of us really knew what would happen. There are a few immediate changes that took place. We want to make sure that we thank both Governor Walz and the legislature for taking some action immediately to help simplify the program. That was instrumental in us being able to handle the additional workload. One of the things that happened immediately is the waiting week, technically called the non-payable week, was waived. That got benefits to folks a little bit faster than usual. Certain eligibility requirements were suspended or eased. There were some changes made to the shared work program. It's a program where employers can reduce hours and then distribute some of the work reduction amongst a number of their employees. There were some federal programs, as Commissioner mentioned, that came in. There is what the commissioners call a top-off. That's a good word for it, an additional $600 per week that the federal government permitted. There was two extended benefit programs that were implemented during that time as well. They're actually an extension of an extension is the way to think about it. The pandemic unemployment assistance is the the new benefit program for those not normally covered by UI. And we had a temporary program called Lost Wages Assistance, which began when the $600 payments ended in the middle of the summer. So those are the few of the programs that we've implemented. As a general rule, I know we were the first in the Midwest region unemployment insurance to implement all the federal programs, and amongst the very first in the country to do that. A couple states, moment for Minnesota pride here, a couple of states claim they implemented earlier than we did, but when we looked at it, all they did was put paper applications out, which is not actually paying people. We were paying people amongst the first in the country. An element that occurred that we don't tend to talk a lot about, but has been important for this is to reflect on the national UI infrastructure. Unemployment insurance is what's called a federal-state partnership. So the federal government is heavily involved in unemployment insurance, and each unemployment program in every state works with all the other states as well. So we're currently paying people not only in Minnesota, but all 50 states and the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. So it's really a national program for each state. We are reaching out across the entire country and paying folks. Part of how that works is that there's a interface that all states share in. It's called the ICON system. And that allows us to send wages back and forth and communicate between the states. About the same day that the pandemic began, that system entirely crashed and became unavailable for several weeks. That meant effectively that we were not able to do some of the authentication work that we do through that system. It also meant that we couldn't share wages with other states, and it created a series of other backlogs that we're still working our way through. So that was very unfortunate. That lasted well into April. It meant that if a worker had wages in both Minnesota and, say, Iowa, we were not able to obtain those wages any longer. It would have been a paper process, and, of course, they were busy, so they had no time to respond to us either. So for that period of time, from that interface level, the whole UI program nationally went back to probably somewhere, I would have to say, around the mid-80s. So we stepped backwards, getting close to 40 years. So that had a big impact on us. The federal directives that came through were a challenge for our partners at the U.S. Department of Labor. They'd never been prepared for a pandemic either. So we were getting federal directives that we have to follow, sometimes several of them a week. Sometimes they were conflicting with one another. And oftentimes they involved adding a great deal more complexity to the program than we had the capacity to handle at that time. So there was a challenge for all of this. Did we just change the unemployment insurance program, or is it the same program that just pays out more people and more money? And that created a challenge for figuring out exactly how these policies and new programs would be implemented. At some level, they're the same old UI programs with the same eligibility requirements, which frankly exceed in complexity our capacity or any other state's capacity to handle. And so we went back and forth with the feds on a lot of their direction several times throughout this process. And a little bit of that is still going on now with moving forward and moving backwards. That's created a challenge for us because we must and we're required to respond to their initiatives. As the commissioner mentioned, part of the reason we're pretty good at what we do is because we're blessed with four seasons here in Minnesota. The winter season for us means a lot of businesses shut down in building and other trades throughout the winter, which means we usually go from, say, 25,000 active claims in October to maybe 100,000, so a fourfold increase over the course of 3 months. That's unusual. We're the most seasonal state in the country. And in order to handle that yearly influx of activity, we have to engineer our work and our business processes to handle that. So the way we do that is what we call internally a triage process. And what we try to do is make sure that those things that don't need to have extra work don't block up the lanes for those that need more work. One of the, we'd mentioned, and you could see in the graph that we immediately spiked upwards so high in those first few weeks. What you would have seen in other states was that they had something that's called a processing delay. That's kind of coded language in unemployment insurance. So processing delay is not necessarily making a payment. It's actually getting all the data put together in order to figure out that somebody's applied for benefits and so forth. So it's really a inside term for unemployment insurance programs. We had virtually no processing delays of that sort. All programs will have some delays related to eligibility. And we've had some of those. Mostly we've been pretty quick there too. But the delays other states experienced were not literally not being able to allow somebody to file for benefits. We never had that problem here in Minnesota, which knock on wood, we won't have it in the future either. In our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, our approach was to implement our disaster plan. Again, like the rest of us, I think we weren't exactly sure what was going to happen. So we have this disaster plan that is focused on what to do in the event that we lose our physical infrastructure, essentially our building. In that case, we focus on the core activities that we do, and we try to remove complexity wherever we can. So we know that we do a lot of different types of work at any one time, but the first thing that we have to do is make sure that we continue paying people that are depending on unemployment insurance. And then we take applications, and there's a series of hierarchies that we work our way through. So we immediately implemented our disaster plan, and working with the governor's office and all of you, got some additional assistance to sort of simplify the program, make it possible to do what we need to do. We reallocated all of our UI staff that were available to us away from the other work and had them helped out with phone calls in order to help those who weren't able to file on the web on their own. We've so far hired and trained 60 new staff. I think everyone knows that's kind of been a challenge during the pandemic to hire up. You still have to train everybody. It's not an easy thing to do with social distancing, et cetera. About 80% of our staff are now working from home. We were working entirely in the building, and so we had to turn around and socially distance all of our staff and then migrate them home with new equipment and new tools. Lots and lots of overtime, then working to try to stay on top of things, and then we've been working to develop new and faster processes to make sure that we stay on top of the work that's been coming through. We did add some technical capacity in the course of the pandemic. We want to thank our friends at Minute for all their work from that. As I mentioned before, we actually did not have any outages. There were a couple times when there were distributed denial of service attacks that were launched against the state of Minnesota as a whole, other states as well. It wasn't just us. And those slowed down our web applications at different times, but really no other impact from our systems, which is remarkable in itself. Normally, we would deploy code about four times a year. This, so far in 2020, we did 30 code deployments, so we were active on that side too. We can't just take new claims and answer the phones. We also have to continuously manage and monitor and maintain our system in order to make sure it's working for everybody. Lots of workarounds were done while the federal system was out. We've also had to build out extensions and do some other processes in the background that helps to make sure that folks don't experience barriers to getting paid. We implemented some slightly different approaches to handling the PUA program. For that program, we have to be able to see income and wages. And so we worked through a sharing agreement with our friends over at Department of Revenue in order to be able to validate that data a little bit better. One of the things that we try to talk with folks about when we get an opportunity is to kind of give some context for what's occurred here and what it really means. We pride ourselves in trying to keep a lot of the complexity of the program hidden away so that everyone doesn't, we don't want to spend a lot of time talking about how hard our jobs are and those sort of things. It's unseemly at the best of times and inappropriate, obviously, now. But there's a lot of complexity that occurs in the background for any UI program. Unemployment insurance is devised as an eligibility program, which means there's a lot of controls and a lot of accounting. And the whole thing is structured around determining eligibility on sort of a case-by-case basis. It scales reasonably well within the context of an unemployment insurance program, and it's designed to handle the workload that we might have from a fairly long and prolonged deep recession, sort of like we had for the Great Recession. The unemployment insurance program is not designed as a pandemic response tool. It does not have those features in it. It has a lot of controls in place that are designed to run regular UI, not a different set of programs. And this has been a challenge for both us and other states to try to scale up and implement programs that it's not really designed to do. What happened during the first few weeks of the pandemic is the Minnesota program went from the normal size we are to roughly the same size as California's program, which is 10 times the size we normally are. If that sort of thing happens as your business is growing, that's good for a business, I suppose, but still creates a lot of challenges for a business. It's very hard to take that kind of growth in any operation without breaking something or risking failure. In UI in particular, there are a lot of controls and accounting features in place that make sure that all the money is accounted for, nobody gets paid that shouldn't get paid, and so forth. Those things are hard-coded in of necessity into our systems. They're not designed to be circumvented very easily. You wouldn't want us to do that. So that makes implementing this program during a pandemic very, very complicated. Some things scale well, so we can handle lots of requests for benefits in a week. Some of the things that don't scale well are more complicated eligibility requirements. And that's been an ongoing discussion we've had with the feds, is increasing the amount of benefits that somebody gets is something that most states can handle pretty well. But adding complicated requirements of eligibility on top of those, or changing them all the time, gets things very, very complicated very quickly, and it makes it hard for us to scale well to those sort of requirements. At this point, we're okay, but we've been stretched very thin for 10 months, and we want to say that we are glad and proud to do the work the Minnesotans need us to do, but we ask that everyone be aware that things are a little bit fragile right now and we don't want anything to break. That was part of the proposal that Chair Noor brought forward, is we're recognizing there's some work we just can't do right now. And we understand that there are a lot of concerns about things, and we want to meet all of those, but we want to also make sure that our program is working well. I'm going to move into the trust fund now. This won't be a long presentation. It's its own subject, and it gets very complicated. This is a pretty overwhelming graph of the last 15 years of the trust fund. You can see that the dark black line is going to represent 2019. You can see that there are periods of time where we've been below the zero level, which is kind of in the center of the page, lower third of the page. That was mostly during the last pandemic. After that, we've been very solvent for the last few years. And obviously, with the pandemic coming through, the trust fund fell very quickly. So we started in March with a balance in the trust fund of about $1.5 billion beginning of March. That would have been considered solvent by United States Department of Labor standards. Over the following weeks, we went through a lot of money very quickly. And by about July 11th, the balance dropped to $21 million and then went negative the week after that. As of just last week, the current balance in the trust fund is negative $1.2 billion. The previous low point was negative $771 million, and that was in 2011 during the Great Recession. Movement in the trust fund and even borrowing is sort of normal. That's the way it kind of is designed to work. Normally, there's interest charged on borrowing. So ordinarily, the federal government charges states interest when they borrow. During the Great Recession, that interest was waived for most of the period of time of the recession. During the pandemic, it was waived for the majority of 2020, and it was waived again in the most recent legislation, but only that's going to end in March, which means that we start accruing interest on the balance, negative balance in the trust fund shortly. The funding structure for UI, this is its own two-week course, which I won't ask you to go through, but the funding structure for UI is designed to respond to seasonal fluctuations. Mr. Chair, there are some questions. I've got a couple slides left. Would you prefer that I stop and answer questions, or that we finish with the slides?
I think we should just finish. I know there are a few slides left, and we can take the questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The UI tax funding structure is designed to respond to seasonal fluctuations and to minor downturns. It's pretty common during a recession that states will borrow. To be clear, the funding structure is not at all designed for pandemics. It's designed for a different type of situation. I know Governor Walz and the National Governors Association is asking Congress to take action on dealing with this situation that's going to exist in just about all the states shortly. Just a quick update on the most recent stimulus package that was passed into law. So that became law on December 27th. There was a little bit of a delay there, but we were able to implement it then over that weekend. The first compensable week was immediately paid. It's 11 more weeks of pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, PUC, 11 more weeks of PUA, that's the one for folks not eligible for UI, and a new top-off program of $300 per week for those otherwise eligible for benefits. As we've said, we were able to get those implemented right away as quickly as they possibly could be, and began paying benefits on the first day that would have been legally possible under the new law. There's some more complexities that Commissioner mentioned a few minutes ago in the new legislation that will, frankly, make some of these a little bit harder to administer. There's a couple other elements of it that makes it a little bit harder to. 11 weeks is great. We're really appreciative of the extra time, but 11 weeks also runs out fairly quickly, which means we go into another set of transitions. The challenges for us are always around transitions. So every time benefits start and stop, it's a lot of anxiety for applicants who are affected by that. It's also technically very complicated to start and stop those. And so that's something we'll be dealing with, I'm sure, for the next several months. There may be some new initiatives coming from Congress we'll have to address. The reimbursements, as Chair Noor mentioned, from under the CARES Act are extraordinarily complicated to implement. We know we've got to work on relieving employer charges where those were affected by the pandemic. Obviously, there's work that we've deferred we need to get back to. Ideally, we would move from a response mode to a recovery mode and kind of the disaster framework at some point. Hopefully, we move out of the pandemic and we restore the program to whatever it's going to be in the future, I guess. And I should just mention that at the same time this other work is being done, we're also working hard on a number of technical projects that will make our the system overall more accessible and flexible for now and in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hegman. I just wanted to acknowledge we do have members, Representative Tujong, Haley, and Baker, who joined us, so they're in attendance. I know there are so many questions. I would like to start with, I don't know whether Representative Baker or Jay Jong, I didn't see who raised their hand first, so I'll defer to you. We'll just start with Vice Chair Jay Jong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To a testifier, can you share, it doesn't have to be right now, perhaps a conversation later or email, but can you share with me where these unemployment claims, which sectors they're coming from, and where are these employees located or geographically, and where are these jobs located? I'm just trying to get a better understanding of where many of these claims are coming from. And I'm also interested in information, because I've been hearing a lot from many constituents and from my colleagues. Do you have information on how many people were denied unemployment insurance, and what were some of the top reasons, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hegman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zhang, the data on the individuals and the characteristics, I believe, are being held on the DEEDS website. So our labor market information folks are doing that work for us right now. I believe that's available to everyone. I have not done any work on any analysis of denials. The provisions of the current law don't result in a lot of denials for under those provisions. So I think there are folks that have experienced delays. Typically that would happen because they have what I what we would call a very complicated work history. So in some cases, we can't tell from what they're where or from what they are unemployed from. And that creates challenges. As I said, the eligibility requirements require us to identify those things. But best that I could, we've not really had, I mean, there have been folks that have been denied, no doubt about it, but I don't have that information for you. I'm sorry, Representative Zhang, right now. We can try to take a look.
Representative Jay Zhang, do you have any follow-up?
Thank you, Mrs. Chair.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Mr. Hegman, thank you for that great presentation. I wanted to, I think, bring up a Yeah, I think everything that we've done to date here during the pandemic has been all about the workers and the unemployment issues. And again, I think the state of Minnesota should be really proud of our running to the rescue, really, for the most part, with everything from the traditional hourly employee to self-employed folks that didn't have a way to go, and you guys really reacted well to that. We have to start talking and switching now to what we need to do for employers. Mr. Hagman and others, I think I want to make sure that we are at a place now because of a couple of issues. I think it's job safety, for workers that maybe aren't quite ready to return to the workforce because their concerns about COVID. And also the extra payments that some folks are getting is an incentive to maybe not look for work or take jobs that are accepted or offered to you. I'm getting a lot of employers that are suggesting, and they're screaming for help, that people aren't coming to work once they're even offered a job because of some of the things I just mentioned. And as employers and businesses have really stepped up, I think, in to do a nice job in making sure their employees are safe, their work environments have never been safer, because if they are unsafe, they won't have a business to go to. So, Mr. Hagman, I guess, has the department been talking about what we can do to make it easier for employers to, again, and as I understand it, once you offer somebody a position and they deny that or they turn you down without cause or something, is there a mechanism that employers have to say, gosh, I offered Dave Baker a job, but he declined it? Do I have to have any follow-up to that? We've got signing bonuses and free college education for some employees if they just come in, and we're at a place now that we need to start switching that. So I'm just curious, has the department started looking at that from that aspect so we can get people back to work as soon as possible?
Mr. Hagman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I appreciate the question. I know Commissioner Grove and others at DEED are working on those issues and would be anxious to have more conversations with you. We, of course, hear some of those things on my end of things as well. I can tell you, we do review and take seriously any of those offers where somebody has refused some employment. We hear the anecdotes too, and we take them all very seriously. So we appreciate when employers let us know when that's happened. As you said, some of the safety issues get complicated because some folks that are unemployed have health conditions that an employer may not know about, but they would tell us about. So that complicates things under the current circumstances. That's the bit that I know about from my perspective, but I know lots of folks are taking that discussion very seriously at DEED, and I know Commissioner Grove would be very anxious to talk more with you about that. It's a serious subject, and obviously we want the labor market to work as effectively and efficiently as possible as well. So these are all great things. I'm just not an expert in those areas. I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair, just to final up, I'm happy to be involved in that process. Mr. Hagman, if you could share that with the commissioner. I was a little late to the meeting, so I apologize, but this is really important. And again, maybe there's a way to prevent the folks that maybe are at risk of taking on certain positions. We don't want them out shopping for jobs if they can't really take it. It really is kind of devastating to the employers going through all those efforts if they really can't work anyway. So we need to dive into that, and I'm happy to help in any way that I can. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Representative Baker. Now I'll go to Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my question was, I think you've all done a phenomenal job, and so appreciative of all you've done to help the workers who need it, and it's been phenomenal. My question was on the slide where you talked about what you're looking at on the horizon, the managing the employer charges, and how straightforward you anticipate that being and timelines on when you might think that might start happening.
Mr. Hagman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, thank you for the question. It is, charges are complicated. Employer charges typically are fairly straightforward. Most separations are layoffs, and under the law, an employer is charged for those. It gets more complicated when the nature of the separation changes, and of course that happened due to the pandemic. The legislature passed some special laws last year that gives us a little bit more latitude to not charge employers where the separation of employment was due to the pandemic. So that's fairly straightforward. The challenge for us is that is a case, we, the way our systems are designed to do that, that's on a case-by-case basis. So we have to review the facts for each one of those. And there's a couple hundred thousand of those right now that are sitting there that take an individual staff person to review. And it is a time-consuming activity to get that done. So that's part of why we've asked for the proposal that Chair Noor forwarded, is to give us the time and the space to get that work done. I am optimistic that we will get that done over the next several months here so that those charges get adjusted back out. It is a messy process that's been greatly complicated by elements of the CARES Act. The CARES Act provides for some reimbursement to states, which is great. So we get some money from the federal government that goes into the trust fund. The challenge with that is, under our law, and makes sense, an employer cannot be charged for any benefits that have been being reimbursed by the federal government. Well, the federal government gave us a nice set of reimbursements that are very, very, very complicated to administer. So one of the things for reimbursing employers is that it's 50% of the charges that would otherwise be charged to them. That's not how charges work in the Minnesota system or in any other state, so far as I know. Charges are kind of binary. They're either on or off, and they're either on or off for an entire claim. They're not on and off for a given week. And so the CARES Act provided the 50% thing, which is very complicated to do, plus a thing for shared work, which is also complicated, and another one for the waiting week waivers. So those elements by us have to be administered first, and then the federal law applies. That's the way the feds want us to do it. So in order to get to employer charges, we have to do something really, really complicated with some federal reimbursements, and then we would go through and do the charges. If we reverse the order on that, there's a chance that we can't access the federal funds, because the feds don't want the funds if we've already relieved the charges. It's the kind of complexity that feels very federal to me. We appreciate the money, but this is a really hard thing to do in the midst of trying to respond to the pandemic. So we think that between some of the other work that we're doing, we should be able to get that all resolved. We're actually honestly hoping that Congress will maybe simplify some of this a little bit for all the states. All the states are struggling with it, and then we can kind of expeditiously get through that. With the proposal that Chair Noor forwarded today, that gives us a window to get that work done. The one thing that we have been very committed to is using some of our administrative authority to make sure that the inability to get to these elements does not create a hardship for employers by increasing their taxes. So for reimbursing employers, we've waived some of the collections activity that we normally do until we can get that work done. And we're essentially trying to do the same thing with this proposal for taxpaying employers. So we're mindful of it. We can certainly keep the committee chair updated with our progress on it. It's not been quick. We would anticipate that we'd have it done by fall at the outside at this point, but the pandemic's been sort of unpredictable for all of us. A lot of our plans, honestly, would be that we'd be in recovery phase by sometime last summer, but clearly that didn't happen. So as we sometimes say, this is our first pandemic too. They don't apparently, not easy to manage for any of us, I guess. So I promise you we'll do the very best we can, and we'll keep you apprised. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's really helpful. I'm sympathetic to the situation, and I look forward to when your department's in a place to be able to do that work. So thank you for doing that.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to start by reminding committee members that unemployment insurance is a business subsidy program. It is so in two ways. One, it provides customers to businesses, because my experience is people with cash in their pocket spend more money than people without. And by providing this assistance to laid off workers, we're providing customers to businesses. Secondly, it helps with employee retention. If I have a lifeline, even one limited as unemployment benefits are, I'm more likely to stay in the community. I'm more likely to return to my previous employer when the economy changes. And that's both a plus for the employer in terms of returning workers, but it also saves them money in training or retraining costs. So with that thought, Mr. Hagman, I'm wondering about the, and I can't keep all of the acronyms straight, the PUA and PUEC. programs. As you know, Minnesota is the only state in the nation that penalizes Social Security recipients who would otherwise qualify for unemployment. And I'm wondering if a applicant who otherwise qualifies, except that they've applied for Social Security, would they still qualify for either of those programs? Or would be they, would the penalty extend to the federal programs as well?
Mr. Hagman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, thank you for the question. Minnesota has a provision for Social Security, the receipt of Social Security retirement benefits that's very similar to the receipt of a pension under other forms. Under that provision in the law, if you were receiving your Social Security pension during the entire, this is unfortunately complicated, during the entire year of your base period, which means that you were working while receiving your pension, then the pension's not, the Social Security pension is not deductible. We disregard that income then. The only time that it's deductible is if you were receiving, had not both worked and received the pension at the same period of time. Having been around when that was done, I'm not going to argue the policy merits one way or the other, but the intention there was that if somebody retires and then tries to collect unemployment benefits, that's not quite the thing to that was desirable, I guess. But if you were working through your retirement, then the unemployment benefits would be available to you. So the deduction for Social Security only applies in sort of the first year of retirement, if you want to look at it that way. The provision applies both to the federal benefits, so it applies to state benefits, regular UI. It'll apply to PUC, and it'll also apply to the PUA programs. And again, it's 50% of the weekly amount of Social Security under those circumstances. So many have no deduction at all because they were working continuously for the last 5 or 10 years. Some folks that recently retired would have a deduction done. I've not had had the opportunity to look to see the difference on it. It reduces the weekly UI amount. It does not remove the balance from the account, so those benefits get spread over a longer period of time, but it does not eliminate the actual balance. So that's the mechanics of how it works. Again, merits one way or the other is a question for you folks.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for that answer, Mr. Hagman. I hope we'll have ongoing conversation about that. A more technical question: in Chair Noor's bill presentation, and unfortunately I'm a visual learner, and so I do much better if I've got a piece of paper or a computer screen in front of me than just listening. So I may not have understood this, but he made a reference to, if I understood, the assessment for employers is intended to be at 60% of the average wage for all employers, something about that. Can you help me understand what he was saying there? And then I may have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Devaney. I think you're referring to the taxable wage base, which was part of the bill that we just passed. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Mr. Hagman.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. The chair is correct. It's the it's how the taxable wage base, which is the amount of wages that an employer pays taxes on, is determined. It is set at 60% of the average wage in the state for in the prior year. So for the year 2020, that number came out to $35,000. Without the proposal that is moved by Chair Noor, that would go up to $36,000 in 2021. The proposal would hold it at the same rate as it was at, or same level as it was at in 2020. I think I'm a visual learner too. We try to not talk about UI taxes in the afternoon as it tends to cause people to fall asleep, but I'll be happy to go over more of it. It's unfortunately very complicated.
All right. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hagman, Thank you both. I've got more questions, but it is the afternoon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Devaney. I think it more explains of how complicated it is, mm-hmm. you know, doing the UI tax process. But quite frankly, the taxable base is just saying 60% of the average Minnesota income. which I think from the previous one was 35,000. So if employer is going to be charged for UI, it's going to be based up to that average, which is 60%, not beyond that. If you're getting 60, 80,000, we're only looking up to that 35,000. I hope I'm correct, Mr. Hegman, that's how I computed. Sometimes I'm more logical in terms of computer systems, so I'm using my programming mode to get to the answer that I'm trying to get to.
I think, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to understand, and we don't have to do this today, but if we're assessing employers at 60% of the average wage, but we're paying laid off employees 50%, I'm wanting to understand that discrepancy. And again, this is the afternoon and may not be the time or the mode to walk through that, but it's that discrepancy that I'm wondering. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hank.
Thank you, Chair Dovney. I think it's the afternoon. It's the average. We'll talk more about it, and I think we'll come up with a formula that will make people understand that calculation before we pass it on Monday. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Mr. Hegman, I just want to reiterate again what a great job I think that your team has done. Having sat next to several employees while they're on the phone going through this process, the level of customer service has just been phenomenal. So through this excessive workload, thank you and good job. I have a question for you, Mr. Hegman. The trade readjustment program that you mentioned in the beginning of your presentation, can you let me know what is that and give me some examples of how that's implemented? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, is it all right if I answer the questions?
Yes, Mr. Hegman, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The Trade Readjustment Program is part of the Trade Act. The Trade Act is a set of programs that provides what we would call dislocated worker assistance for individuals who have lost their job due to foreign trade. I have not been keeping up with the particular instances of it that are in use right now. Oftentimes it would be a manufacturing plant that was competing with some offshore manufacturing, and then the individuals at that facility lost their jobs as a result of that. The one that comes to mind immediately is at the tail end of the Great Recession, a number of the iron mines on the Iron Range had to close due ostensibly to that sort of competition as well. And those groups were eligible then for trade assistance. So it does a couple of things. It does some retraining money. It's really for retraining, it's sort of the gold standard of retraining programs in our business. Provides a good structure and a lot of support for folks that need to get retrained to go back to work. An element of that is the trade readjustment, I'm trying to remember the name of it, assistance. It's the UI portion of it. So it's like an extended benefits program. In this case, it gets very complicated. There's an ordering always when there's extended benefits programs. It always starts with regular UI as the preferred program, and then it walks through the next set of federal programs, then ultimately state programs. Then it gets to, and the very last one would be the TRA program in terms of order. So that would be some folks who had lost their job due to trade competition, foreign competition, and then were in the TAA program and had presumably run out of regular benefits and extended benefits and then moved finally to the TRA benefits. Oftentimes we don't report those because the numbers are relatively small. So I'm glad you asked. It's an interesting program that really is very helpful under some circumstances.
Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up question. Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Hegman, then this would be industry specific just to deal with trade, correct? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hegman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be even tighter than industry. It would actually come down to a particular business. So it wouldn't be industry-wide. It would come right down to a particular plant. Oftentimes it's manufacturing of some sort, and it would come right down to that plant. It could even come down to a subpart of the plant in some cases where it would be one line of production was struggling to compete with foreign competition, and that line had to close. So it can be that narrow in that program.
Representative Franke, any follow-up?
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hagman. So I don't see any other members. I think I have a few questions. I just wanted to get some information or background. So the first one is the special additional benefits that we approved during the last special session. So help us understand, given the timeline for the federal coming to an end by, I believe it's going to be March 14th of 2021. What happens to the special additional benefits that we approved? You're muted. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, the interaction between any set of extensions are defined in part by state law, largely by federal law. So the feds get to decide which program comes first. We were careful to structure the additional benefits so that the federal programs would come first and you know, the expense wouldn't shift to Minnesota where that was avoidable. The timing for the end of both the special additional benefits and the new programs that Congress put into place recently is such that there is a possibility that the special additional benefits would kick in towards the end of their timeline because of folks exhausting the new PUC benefits that are made available through the extension of the CARES Act. So it is possible that the special additional benefits would be getting paid, at least in some circumstances. We've not been able to take everything apart yet, and it's always very complicated to try to figure out when people will run out of benefits. Folks work on and off and so forth. So 11 weeks of benefits for some people, that's 11 straight weeks. For other people, that could last them 20 weeks if they're requesting benefits. So it's not something that we can predict very easily, but the calendar and the math of the whole thing means that that we could find ourselves paying those special additional benefits later.
Thank you, Mr. Hagman. Along the same line, we appropriated $25 million for the reimbursing employers. How is that going to be implemented, given that we do have a federal program and there's also the 50% reimbursable? Are we going to be able to utilize the additional resources to help the reimbursing employers?
Mr. Chair, members, the $25 million was a little unclear to me, honestly, how that and when that particular amount would be applied and under what circumstances. The monies would come out of, as I understand the provision, would come out of general funds. And we are looking to our colleagues at MMB to help us understand under what criteria that a release of those funds would take place. So I'm afraid I just don't have an answer for you. I don't understand well enough how that would be applied in our situation.
We'll follow up on that one, because this was only one-time appropriation from the general funds to help relieve the burden for the reimbursing employers. Quite frankly, those are employers from mostly nonprofit, tribal, and government entities. So we will need to look into that in details. And also, Mr. Hagman, the commissioner mentioned the mixed income, mixed income earners for the UI. Can you let us know how is that proceeding, the additional $100 for individuals who have got mixed income?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. One of the features of the extension of the programs that Congress passed recently was that they added a number of eligibility conditions. So all the states and the Department of U.S. Department of Labor lobbied Congress to try to deliver extensions of those programs in a manner that was relatively simple to administer. I was on a number of calls after that. The consensus is that while the additional assistance is appreciated, in fact, they're all made much more complicated. One such example is the mixed earners unemployment compensation. The intent there for that federal law was to provide up to $100 more per week to individuals who were self-employed, but who are covered by the regular unemployment insurance program because they had some covered employment. And then the notion was that the regular UI benefits were significantly lower because they could not include the self-employment income. And I'm sorry, I don't have the exact thresholds on it in my readily available to me right now. But in response to that, Congress made this mixed earners program. And the way that that would have to work is we would have to find proof of significant self-employment earnings, net income, not gross income, but net income, and that would be sufficient for us to then make a payment of an additional $100. So for each individual worker who was interested, or a self-employed person that was interested in that, we would have to establish their gross income in the previous tax year for these purposes, that would be 2019. And we'd have to see, I'm sorry, their net income, I should say, so not gross, but net from self-employment, and then it would have to be sufficient in order to meet the threshold for that program to pay them. It is a very complicated sort of thing to do. It requires that we have firm documentation from each individual that's interested in it, and that we go through their tax records in many cases to establish that. Again, it's all going to get audited as well. We are in the process of creating all the questionnaires and the requirements and establishing all the rest of the things we have to do with it. And I think we'll be rolling that out in another week or so, hopefully pretty quickly. But it's unfortunately one of those programs that is going to be very labor intensive and not nearly as straightforward for the self-employed person as probably they would have hoped.
Mr. Hegman, I know I've got a few other questions just to make sure that people understand the UI process. So I just wanted to inquire about the base period and what is the, you know, minimum income does a person have to qualify for UI?
Mr. Chair, members, the base period, the base period is a moving 12-month, moving four-quarter period. Is very hard to do on the spot when you're sitting in front of a committee. So it's a four-quarter period of time. Currently for January, it would be the fourth quarter of 2019 through the third quarter of 2020. So it would be October 2019 through the end of September 2020. And then it moves a quarter every quarter. It moves forward one quarter. It's currently $3,100 in that total base period. So $3,100 spread across 52 weeks is sufficient to get the minimum level of weekly benefit amount under our state laws. Minnesota has one of the lower thresholds. Some states have very complicated and very restrictive thresholds in order to establish a benefit account.
Thank you, Mr. Hegman. I'll give you quick two questions and then I think I will follow up with some of the other questions. So the question that we have is, what triggers the extended benefit for the state? What triggers to make it on and off? Because we've seen individuals who had used most of their, all the UI for the 39 weeks, and then they had 1 month or so that they can qualify for continuous benefits. So can you cover a little bit about, because we want to understand what really triggers the extended benefits for the state.
Mr. Chair, members, there are several extended benefit, I'm going to call it extensions of benefits programs. So there are federal extensions, there's a state extension, that was the special additional benefits that you recently passed. And then there's a kind of a hybrid that sits between the two of those. And that's called the Extended Benefits Program. And the shorthand for that is EB. That means something very specific. So EB is not a generic term. It applies to a very specific program that is half federal and half state. So under normal circumstances, it's 50% federal funded by the federal government and then 50% funded by the states. The EB program has what we call triggers associated with it. And those triggers are based on a couple different things. I don't have my law book in front of me, so I'll do it off the top of my head, but there's three triggers. One of them is based on the overall unemployment or for the total unemployment rate. Total unemployment rate is the one that usually gets published and that you see all the time. So one trigger is based on that. The other two triggers are based on what's called the insured unemployment rate. Based on those triggering points, if the state crosses that trigger, then the EB program is triggered on, and it stays on for at least 13 weeks. But once the state drops below that triggering point, once the unemployment rate drops below those triggers, then the program triggers off. So it's very complicated. It's also quite archaic, and it does not work very well. It's federal law mostly. The main trigger, the total unemployment rate, as I said, is the one that our agency publishes periodically, monthly, and that you're probably all more familiar with. There's also something called the insured unemployment rate, which is the portion of it's essentially the portion of people that the unemployment insurance program is paying on the regular UI program divided by the covered employment in the state. So it's very similar, but it usually ends up being about half of what the total unemployment rate is. So it's about in that neighborhood most of the time. The problem with the insured rate triggering system is it's actually based on the number of folks that we're paying in the regular UI program. Well, when you go into a recession or you go into the pandemic, obviously, then what ends up happening is people run out of benefits in the regular program. They leave that program and they go to an extended benefits program. That means they come off as the numerator in that calculation. And so part of what a couple things were going on. One is the unemployment rate in Minnesota dropped rather quickly in the fall. So that's the total rate. The other thing that happened is the UI program was moving folks into the extended benefits program, which means they came off from the, I think that's right, the numerator in the calculation. And so we triggered off for insured unemployment on the insured employment rate too. And I'm sorry, you seem to like detailed answers to things. It's a very complicated and very archaic structure, and it's insured to kind of shut itself off under these circumstances.
Thank you so much, Mr. Heckman. I think you've explained it in a good way to give a background to the members, and we appreciate all the great work your department is doing. I know it's a challenging moment for all of us. I understand there will be so many conversation about creating some changes in the UI infrastructure. I know we will have the advisory meeting tomorrow for members. I think if you can explain what is the role for the UI advisory, which is scheduled for tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The UI Advisory Council has historically served a couple of different purposes. Ideally, the program uses it in part to bring forward issues that we would want those that are interested in these matters, typically administrative issues, hopefully to make the program work a little more smoothly. So we would use it as an opportunity to bring those matters before folks like yourselves, representatives, and also other members of interested communities, members of the employer community, and a couple of unions are represented as well, to discuss those matters and to share ideas about the future, proposals that might be interesting to other members. We're trying to make some changes there, to be honest with you, to turn it into a broader conversation. We think that unemployment insurance is interesting. It's certainly been interesting over the last year. And we want to share some of the background and information that we have and help folks be help us to do a good job of managing and operating the program. And we've not always made that real easy, to be frank. So we're trying to bring the folks together and discuss those proposals. This year, the program itself does not have anything particular. We're frankly been a little busy over the last year to be able to do too many technical sort of things. I know that a number of members of the council have proposals they'd like to discuss, and so we'll be doing that tomorrow. It's an opportunity to what we're trying to move towards is to make sure that discussion takes place, and to the extent possible for those of us who are in the administration of the program, help to explain to the other members what the implications of the proposal might be. you know, provide information is our primary goal. Mr. Chair, members, we were hoping to use 2020 to sort of reform how we were operating the council to make it more of an educational opportunity and share more issues, but the pandemic got in the way of that. So I think we're going to try to do sort of a hybrid meeting tomorrow. I know you've got some proposals you wanted to discuss, and others do as well. We're looking forward to that and facilitating a discussion amongst all the members of the council. Longer term, we would like that to be more educational than we got an opportunity to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hegman, for your presentation and for giving us all the answers. So members, tomorrow, I'm hoping that you'll be able to join and just listen to. And if you have got bills, I know some of us are presenting ideas. So looking forward to that conversation. And just wanted to say thank you again to Deed and the UI team for the great work that they've done for all of us. We're proud of the work that you're doing. So members, for the next session, we will have the economist and the state economist and demographer who are gonna walk us through some of the questions that you've had about the economy and so many other things. So look forward to seeing you all. I just wanted to inquire if there's any discussion or questions from members at this point. Don't see any questions. Travis, do we have anything else that we wanted to cover?
Mr. Chair, I believe that concludes the agenda for today.
With that, the meeting is adjourned. So thank you so much, members.